power of our diplomacy. Diplomacy.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really big deal.
The strength of our diplomacy.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
One. Deadline.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome to episode 21.
21.
21. Legal. Drinking. We had an email that suggested that we celebrate by drinking.
Well, which would be a good idea, but unfortunately we can't do it.
No, we totally can't. It is episode 21 of Diplomacy Cast. Diplomacy Cast is a podcast about the board game Diplomacy. I'm Eric Mead.
I'm Nathan Barnes.
Yes, yes you are.
Thank you. I love it when I get that one right.
For today's episode, we have Power Plays Hot Off the Presses in an interview. You know, just to change it up.
Oh, is that because we've really previously been doing... how is that different at all?
No, it's not.
Oh.
This time, actually, let's do Hot Off the Press and then Power Plays and then an interview. No, that's actually always how we do it, too.
Oh.
Yeah, okay.
Snickerdoodles.
But we have interesting topics and interesting interview subjects and interesting emails.
Well, we'd hope, otherwise we wouldn't talk about them.
We're going to talk today about knowing your opponent.
Yes.
Learning his or her tendencies and...
pressing your advantage with that.
Yeah. Yeah, that sort of thing. We got a bunch of great email. Way to bring it.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Emailers, for once.
Yeah, that's good. You know how you reinforce behavior? Definitely mock it.
Yeah, you're
that's
right.
Really how right. That's going to work.
Thanks for all the great emails.
Yeah, no, everyone. Actually, it was a lot more than we expected.
We're going to interview tournament stalwart, close personal friend, awesome
all around
dude.
Great guy.
Brian Sheldon.
One caveat before we get started, I want to just note, I know a couple episodes ago we said we were going to write your questions to Alan Kalhammer. We did, and we're still waiting a response. I'm still going back and forth. Alan's taking a little while to really think about the answers to the questions we posed him that were sent in from our readers and whatnot.
So yeah, so...
That will be on an episode at some point.
Hang in there.
We haven't forgotten. It's not us.
It may have been the worst idea we've ever had for this show, but darn it.
I don't know.
Keeping the faith.
April Fool's is coming up again.
That's true. If you have any questions, any feedback, anything, press at diplomacycast.com, diplomacycast on Facebook.
That's a good place to go.
Subscribe to us on iTunes.
Eric loves it when you do that.
I really do. Hope you enjoyed that little interlude there. We're back at Studio One again, and so I had to clean up cat pee.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what, but it's worth it for the space.
Yeah.
You know, we really get the good sound here.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. It's great here.
So let's read some emails.
You don't want to talk about WAC first?
Oh, yes. For those of you that don't know, the annual Seattle tournament, the Washington Athletic Club... Con?
Sure.
The convention.
Tournament.
Convention.
I don't like that.
WACON tournament is coming up. February 1st and 2nd. It's going to be great. And what's the most important thing about it this year is it's our second to last year. Next year will be the last year that we are doing WAC. And so if you can't make it this year, that's okay. If you can, you should, just so you know that next year is going to be sort of multiples more awesome. It's going to be good. Next year's going to be sick.
It's going to be so sick that somebody at the next year one is just going to be like, screw it, I'm moving to Seattle. I'm just going to start hosting a tournament.
Yeah, I'm just going to take up the mantle.
Yeah.
So definitely, it's going to be a great event. We're doing three rounds. You know, all the usual WAC stuff. If you have questions about it, drop us a line. I'll happily answer you any questions you might have. You can also find it on Facebook. Just type in, you know, WAC Con 2013. You should be able to figure it out.
Now we can read email.
Okay. Sorry, I was excited about the emails. We got some great emails.
Hot off the press.
Hot off the press.
Hot off the press.
Yeah, there's people don't use the press anymore.
Drop it like it's hot.
Oh, so if we just dropped it like it was hot?
If we just dropped it like it was hot, you can do better than that.
Drop it like it's hot.
Off the press.
I'm not saying that.
All right, cool.
This is sort of a content-free couple of emails that I just wanted to read really quick.
They're good emails.
Yeah.
They make us feel good. Frankly, these are just ego-stroking emails.
Yeah, exactly. They both come from Heath Gardner. He said, the podcast is amazing. I've been sort of on the periphery of the hobby for quite some time, but have met some of the greats at various DixieCons, including Eric, years ago. Oh, awesome.
You don't remember, do you?
I haven't been to DixieCon in, like, 7 years. Am I forgiven?
No, this one. Sure.
All right. Cool. So
I would have remembered.
Of course you would have. I remember if I saw his face. So I love the interviews, especially, and the strategy talk is top notch. I have some friends who are new to diplomacy and are quickly losing their lives to it in the best way. I will be definitely sharing this podcast with them. Yes, that's
does
what we like to
does
hear.
Does he tell us where he's at? Because that would be great to maybe try and connect him up with some other people if he's getting some house games together. You know, it's always.
He did Ooh. Not.
Well, so Heath, drop us a line. Let us know where you're at, and maybe we can connect you with some people and see if we can, you know, make some good things happen.
And yeah, for sure. And then Heath wrote us another email, apparently got tired of waiting for us to read the first one. So he wrote another one like a couple of weeks later that he said that he just had LASIK, and so he's had nothing to do all day but lie around in bed with his eyes closed listening to podcasts. Which.
That's pretty epic, yeah. Honestly.
I love that.
Honestly, if I was blind, I'd probably listen to this too.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, look, it's friend of the show, Matt Shields.
Friend of the show, Matt Shields. Matt Shields has a polite, hey, you guys missed something.
He's really good at that.
Yeah.
Full of compliments and niceness, and hey, by the way, you forgot something.
Yeah. And it actually is a good little, let's spend a couple minutes on the thing. Good job on the Stalemate Line episode, he writes. You covered most of what I would have without getting bogged down in too many details that frankly, you can learn better by reading them on the pouch than by listening to a description of them on the radio.
Which is exactly what we thought.
We accomplished that goal.
High five.
There is one thing I think is worth spending a couple of minutes talking about that you didn't mention, though. There is one major complication that can arise when multiple players are trying to reach a stalemate line to defend it. Because they are separate players and not one big power, their units aren't interchangeable. This restricts where they can move without cutting supports, and very importantly, can cause the problems with them needing to move into each other's centers, possibly resulting in important units being disbanded. This is probably most common if you have, for example, Austria, Turkey, and Italy trying to work together to defend the middle from a German or Russian player trying to move to the middle of the board.
Right.
So suppose Austria has his home centers and nothing else, and his units are in Tyrolia, Vienna, and Galicia. There might well be a stalemate line that could lock this up if the Allies could get a unit into Trieste or Budapest, but if only Turkey or Italy can move in there, then Austria will lose the supply center and have to remove a critical unit. This is true.
Right, and so yeah. I think we weren't really expressed with this. And I think it was maybe a layer that we weren't really trying to get that deep into it, but
totally right.
And that's really very, very right about this. I think he's really sort of identify the next step when you're looking at putting these stalemate lines together and you have, let's say, what's typically like a six, three on three, the Western triple, the Eastern triple, or maybe four and four. And remembering that while you have the units and the geographical position to effectuate that stalemate line, really sometimes you can't do it.
Yeah,
because it requires the cutting of a support or a removal of supply center that undermines the whole thing.
Right.
So,
this happens pretty much any time I'm working together with people to try and hold together a small position. This will happen at least once where we'll be like, crap, we really need to be in Budapest right now. And then you have to figure out, like, okay, if the Turk is in Budapest, I have to remove one. What would I remove and what would he build? That sucks.
This negotiation about, okay, you have to waive a build and then I get it back next year after I can convoy Greece to Constantinople with your unit, sort of these, like, that's where, you know, that's really where the sausage is getting made, you know, it's good stuff.
Exactly. And I never, like, think about it until I'm in this situation where I'm like, well, we can't do this all of a sudden, you know, like, and stalemates fall apart at that point. And, like, sometimes people accidentally get eliminated, which is a real drag.
Well, I've
definitely had that happen before where we're just like, whoops, thanks for your help. You're out.
And this is the point, like, the other side is if you're paying attention and you can see and you can identify these tensions, or if just the other side's pretty obvious about it,
yeah.
You know, you're working just to muck that up.
Yep.
Like, can we accidentally, you know, you like throw unexpected support or cut something, yep, here and there, force a retreat, you know, these sort of things.
Yeah, that, definitely. When you're the advancing side, yeah, when you're the big side, you can go, oh, look, they really can't cover Budapest here, because the only way that they could cover Budapest is by turning it over to the, right, other guy, and they can't do that. And they're going to know they can't do that, so they're not going to try. They're going to guess the other thing instead. And
right, or and then taking a moment to sacrifice your position, perhaps, like, maybe not advancing when you could, to really cripple the other side.
Right.
You know, just weighing those options, the pros and cons. I really appreciate Matt sending that in. And
yeah, definitely. He sums it up: just because there exists a 13-center stalemate line that, exactly, Turkey can hold, there might not be a 13-center stalemate line that Turkey, Austria, and Italy can hold all working together.
Yep. Right, exactly. Good. Well said, Mr. Shields.
Bravo. Okay, next one. Oh. Imagine us finding this in our mailbox. From no less a man than Larry Peary.
Larry Peary!
We thought we'd lost him, and all of a sudden he's come flooding back all over the couch and everything. And
Larry.
And he just wanted to write us just, well, about a bunch of little things. He addressed it to Chris, Eric, and Nathan, Chris Babcock, yeah, our guest from the last episode, but Chris is not here to enjoy the email with us, and so we'll do our best. Thanks for the heads up on Diplomacy Cast. I thought I'd seen it all, but I never dreamed someday I would hear it all and all and all. Chris enjoyed the interview. It gave me some much-needed background on what's going on. Eric and Nathan.
Okay.
This is us.
Right, because Chris had said that Chris had looped Larry in, yeah, which we should thank him for.
Yeah, for sure. Tip of the hat to you. Fine job. I didn't realize how long that thing was going to be, and so I turned it on and stuck something in the microwave for dinner. Well, that got burned because I was distracted by the show, so I popped something else in the microwave, and sure enough, it burned too. A suggestion for you. Contact ConAgra and ask them to sponsor your show. They'll make a fortune and increase sales from people burning their dinners listening to you.
That's not a bad idea.
We'll take what we can get.
Yeah,
I particularly enjoyed the discussion of stalemate lines. After listening to it, I realized how much of what you were saying was stuff that I'd heard before. It took me back a long time, nearly 50 years, to the old face-to-face games I used to play with Von Metzky, Walker, Naus, etc. We spent names that Nathan and I have heard. Of course, from long ago. We spent a couple of years playing almost weekly looking for stalemate lines. Conrad especially could create them out of the top of his hat. Rod would try and destroy them, and Hal would ultimately pronounce whether it was or wasn't, and that settled it. See, I love this, because I know it's something that happened a long time ago that we don't get to do anymore, because these guys found them all.
Yeah, just, this fly. Work has been done.
He says, more on that on my bit for Hal coming up in the next Diplomacy World. By the way, Hal was probably the best student ever of the game, at least as far as I know. Rest in peace to Hal, of course. And again, look for that article, listeners, in Diplomacy World coming up. Chris was right. After 3 years, a half dozen hospital stays and several million bucks, and God only knows how many pills, I'm back, at least for now. I figured I'd better use the second chance to catch up on some things, including the hobby and the game. After all, when you're a dipper and you put your priorities right, what else is there to do?
Exactly.
Well said. You guys are a hoot, even if you were sober.
Well, we won't always be. Yeah, promise.
No, don't worry. I want to say 2-3 episodes ago. But regards, Larry Peary. That was great to hear from you.
Yeah, I hope we see you around, Larry. I'm really looking forward to it. I haven't seen you in many years, and it'll be a good time.
And in the tradition of hearing from out of the blue from ancient hobby luminaries, we have one from David Hood here.
Well, you know, we've at least interviewed
venerable wizened hobby luminaries,
and
old person, joke, old joke,
and person that has been kind enough to have us interview him and be an all around stand up. Guy supporting the underpinnings of the entire hobby.
The secret master of diplomacy. First of all, guys, I've been catching up the last few days on some newish episodes. Nice job. I agreed with virtually all your comments about soloing.
Wow. Oh, that's pretty good.
That's weird, because you solo and we don't. So maybe it's the virtual.
Maybe we're good students, yeah. or something, but we're not executing. We're still working on.
We'll listen to episode 20 this weekend and give you any feedback on our stalemate line discussions.
Well, that would be cool.
DixieCon will be held again over Memorial Day weekend 2013. I will be updating the www.dixiecon.com website late today, so I'm sure he's done that by now. He wrote this a little while ago. I will begin to lay the groundwork for hosting World DipCon 2014. So that did happen.
That did happen.
All right.
That did happen. And honestly, listeners, if you can get out to DixieCon, I have not. I'm not been, but I'm strongly thinking about going this year.
I went twice, and it was a while ago both times, but it's brilliant.
Yeah. I think this so is, now that some of the other obligations are gone, I think I'm going to go. So join me.
It'll yes.
Maybe Eric will go. We can get Eric to go, too.
It could happen. Which will be held at Dixie, as you've already reported. I will be putting together a group of hobby luminaries to help me, which will certainly include you two, so prepared to say yes when I officially ask you.
I hadn't even read that part. Yeah. We've pre-answered. I've pre-answered. Eric's kind of a...
Yes, I'll certainly plug it on the podcast. How's that? I know one special thing I plan to do is formally induct the members of the Order of the Knife, my way of recognizing all past DixieCon winners. David Hood.
Yep, Mr. Hood.
DixieCon's going to be...
Yeah.
So DixieCon 2014, so this year's just regular DixieCon coming up, and then the year after that.
Yeah, they don't do Worlds twice in a row, Eric.
Whatever. they do when I don't make the last one, or if they know what's good for them, what?
Whoa, now.
All right. Okay, next we heard from our friend... I'm just plowing through these, man.
Well, you're doing a good job.
It's a good crop this week, month, whatever. Russ Dennis, who wrote us that he's got all these people in Iowa.
Oh, yeah.
We gave him a shout-out for his group.
I'm sure his poll, like his whole club, probably exploded after we dropped that little bit of that plugged in. I'm sure he's got, like, another whole board.
He wrote, summed up that he did, in fact, have that once-a-month event. They got one board. I'm just sort of skimming here, because the recap's kind of long. But, oh, no. Okay, so they got a short one board, and they played a variant where England and Turkey are neutral with units that just hold. I guess you could do that if you only get five.
Yeah, that's fine.
I also found a tournament timer on Nathan's blog, so that was fun to use.
Huh?
Different Nathan. All right, that's cool.
Or I might have something on him somewhere.
Yeah.
If I have a blog, I'm a diplomacy blog, I'm not aware of it.
But it's like those fake Twitter accounts that celebrities get.
Oh, yeah.
I am Nathan Barnes. I am wearing cool pants.
I am a D-list diplomacy list celebrity.
Yeah. The highest meet I've had, it included two boards, but I wouldn't say we're self-sustaining yet. We're getting there. I actually found several new players on Facebook last week, bringing my total list to over 50. And yes, I've already had Jim O'Kelly contact me about the tournament. So why are we even reading this part then?
He's shocked.
He's taken care of. He's fine. Yeah.
He's
within what? Like a 400-mile radius of Jim O'Kelly.
Yeah, so he knows about it.
Yeah. Okay.
But this is the reason why. This is why, because Russ is the only one and the winner of our little contest of who gets to have Eric Mead in an online game.
By the way, I'm starting an online game for our members at Play Diplomacy. Most of these players don't know each other, so there shouldn't be any advantage for a newcomer. If you want, I could get you into it. Don't worry, I'll keep your identity secret if it suits my purposes. All right, email me, Russ.
Yeah, no, that's it.
Make this happen.
Yeah, email or just sign him up.
Yeah.
You know, just
so I can't change my mind.
So he can't change his mind.
I will try and weasel out of it.
Yeah.
You're not wrong.
Oh, of course you
will. All right. So me and six folks from Iowa. It's on. It's happening. Yeah. I'm ready. What we got here? Oh, yeah. Last one. This is James from South Australia.
Australia.
Who we heard from once before. He says, first, it's kind of long, but I'm going to read it because it's interesting. First of all, a short backstory to my question. I have recently started hosting House Games of Diplomacy at my house in Newcastle, Australia. I invited five friends and my brother to come play. Only three of us had ever played before, so it was an introductory game for the other four, as well as a face-to-face first for two. Okay. Skimming. He decided to start a secondary board on his laptop using a mapping program because one of his guests was partially colorblind, and I actually am too, and have some trouble with the France-Italy pieces sometimes.
Yeah, it depends on the set, right?
Or like Germany-England in some sets. Yeah. They're kind of confusing. A day before the event, I was setting up and decided we would use four rooms in the house for the game so people could have private conversations, and I had an idea. I quickly got together four computers and set them up in the four different rooms of the house. I downloaded TeamViewer, a program that allows meetings that can stream a computer desktop, and set each PC to stream exactly what was on the monitor of the laptop near the board. This allowed me to put a live stream of both the current map and the timer in every room we were using.
Nice.
All the players loved the game and loved being able to see a live timer window as well as a clean, easy-to-see map of Europe, including units, and I thought that idea to stream info to the different rooms was awesome. My colorblind friend was also really happy to be able to differentiate his units from the other. I know I probably went a little into overkill in the whole event organization, but here is my question. In what way is technology able to be used in face-to-face diplomacy, and how will it affect the game? And then he goes on a little bit more. For instance, iPads linked through Wi-Fi that could show a virtual version of the board where they can input their orders without the need to write anything down, all to be revealed at once and automatically adjudicated. Do you think that going more toward technology-run games will help make the game less painless? As in our game, all the information needed was at everybody's fingertips, or do you think that it will ultimately break down some of the social aspects of the game, such as the resolution of orders all around the board?
What? So you wanted to know what I think?
Yeah.
Huh. That's weird. You usually start off with, you know, what you think. I'm just screwing with you. No, I actually think there's a lot of interesting conversation we can have about this. There are some aspects of it, and we have tried it in various tournaments to incorporate increasing amounts of technology. The central clock is a good example of trying to find a way to keep games on track and give the whole room a sense of the clock without actually having to be at the table. So in some events, like we did in WDC in Vancouver in 2007, we had a projector where we projected up the clock, so mm-hmm. the entire room could see it. That's one example. And obviously sort of not anywhere near as complex or as sophisticated as what James has put together.
Yeah.
I think there's nothing wrong with having, say, a webcam trained on a board and having that, you know, stream out to different rooms. I think that could be nice.
It'd be really hard in a tournament situation where there's multiple boards. Yeah. You'd have to have a lot of rooms for that.
I think it's not really an option and you could do it with a top board, which I think you've done various things for top boards.
Yeah, I know last time, like, somebody was tweeting a top board, and that was cool, actually.
But what kind of caught my eye was the idea of inputting orders and whatnot on sort of on a real time basis, and I think that can be a little bit more problematic. I think you have some issues.
Here's the downside of that comes to mind. The downside of that is that, and he kind of alluded to it in his email. The idea of auto-adjudicating instead of hand-adjudicating is great if everybody there is experienced and totally understands why everything happens, but we actually just played a house game here in Seattle not too long ago, and there was a couple weeks ago. There was a couple people who'd never played the game before, and for them, the process of actually going through and hand-adjudicating was a learning experience.
Right.
We'd go, okay, this piece tried to move here, this piece tried to move here, this piece got dislodged, do you see why?
Right.
You know, this support got cut. And so I suppose among experts, that's probably fine, but even tournaments have some pretty new players that,
right.
You know, and I feel like especially some of those new players might feel kind of hard done by if every once in a while, like, something came out of the computer that wasn't what they thought was going to come out of the computer. That would be my worry.
I think to sort of reframe what you're saying, like, you don't want to turn adjudication into a black box that spits out an answer and you're not really understand why. Most of the time, and you just want to remove any sort of, like, that idea of the unknown. You want to really take out anything where people feel like they've been done wrong.
Yeah.
So, for the teaching aspect that you've said, but also for, like, the transparency aspect, like, when you feed something into something, you want to make sure that the machine didn't make a mistake.
Exactly.
And obviously, you know, people who played online, these things don't really make a lot of mistakes. In a tournament setting, when you have so many different varieties of experience, I think you might run into problems.
Having said that, the streaming... streaming the board to your iPad, like, it's a freaking great idea.
Sure.
I don't know why I never thought of before, and maybe we're going to ask Brian Sheldon about this, because he likes to write stuff like that.
It's just to be a video feed only. I can see, like, accidentally having an audio feed on there, and then people standing around the board, and then one guy with his iPad going, okay, you know what I'm doing now.
Yeah, definitely. And then maybe even some sort of way of submitting your orders electronically, but they still get read and adjudicated by hand.
Right, maybe there's a central iPad or a centralized something that the adjudicator or the game master, if there's one.
Yeah, you just put it in as text. Basically,
yeah.
And then the main thing that accomplishes is it keeps the masses of crumpled up paper from accumulating.
Well, it also creates an accurate record of the game, which is nice.
And it makes fewer trees scream.
Yeah, the downside is I'll just say, and then we can move on.
Yeah.
Anytime there's a time pressure, which you often have at tournaments, you're going to run into problems of people trying to type out their orders without, instead of writing it,
you'd much prefer my handwriting?
I'm not only one person. Like, I would prefer a Muppet write your orders than you, but
I actually have a Muppet writing my orders. Anyone who's seen my handwriting knows
it does look like it. But what I'm saying is, I would actually prefer if you typed it. But there, but when you get down to the wire and you have 20 seconds to write out all your orders, you probably can't do that typing.
Yeah,
it's hard to half-ass it, you know.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah,
just something to consider. But I really like this conversation, and we're gonna talk about this with Sheldon, because he's a genius at this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. We might not even talk about any of what we wanted to talk about with him, because he'll get, like, really excited about that.
And... You know, that's the best thing about our interviews. We really let the interviewee drive.
Yeah,
that's right,
for sure.
Well, thanks, James. Oh, James, since you're in Australia.
Oh yeah, that's right. He had one more part of his email. What were you going to say?
I just want to make sure, like, you're connecting with the Australians down there.
No, he's done one better. He's attached a paragraph. He's now the Australian with whom to connect. You ready? Also, as I have started the hobby in my area, I would like to ask if I could grab a shout out from you guys to anyone in Newcastle, Australia. I have created a currently memberless Google group called the Diplomats of New South Wales, where those from the state can connect. Anyone who is interested can email diplomatsofnsw@googlegroups.com. My collection of mates and I are currently planning our next house game and looking to make it a regular event, maybe every month, etc. Thanks for listening to my rantings. Can't wait until the next podcast, James.
Well, James, and I excuse my ignorance of Australian geography, because I'm where New South Wales is in relation to New Zealand and Sydney.
Pulling
and,
up the map.
And whatnot. I think it's it's in New South Wales. It's all in the kind of the general area there.
Yeah.
It's all on the East Coast. So if you haven't been able to, you've heard our podcast, I'm sure you've heard of Melissa Call, who's down there, who, I don't know, she's not that active in the game, but she does keep a finger in it.
Yep.
And we'll know what's going on. And then Sean Coleman,
yep,
who's down there, has for years been working with organizing games. He hosted Worlds, or in conjunction with the Australian hobby down there, put together Worlds in 2011, I think.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are people that you can also reach out and connect to, and you get involved in their circuits, they get involved in your circuits, and they might know people in New South Wales as well. So definitely reach out, and anything we can do to help with that, just drop us a line, and we will eventually connect with you.
Yeah, for sure. Even if you are a million hours away from
any No, I mean, just, you know, sometimes our emailing is not as prompt, but we definitely we always get to it, and we will.
No. It literally takes that long to travel from Seattle to Australia to the emails. Yeah, I know a lot of stuff about a lot of stuff. All right, we got to move on. Power plays.
Yes, power plays.
Power plays.
Power plays.
Power plays.
So, power plays.
Yeah. All right, so this is kind of a... No, not the hardcore strategy stuff like the stalemate stuff was that we talked about last time. It's more of a diplomatic topic, but one that we've touched on a few times without ever taking on directly, and something that I think is kind of a big part of the game. And that is, I mean, obviously when you play against a group of six strangers, this is not going to come up. Like,
yeah.
When you play against a group of six strangers... you're going to try your best throughout the game to be learning what it is that they do.
Right. You're gonna be at the first stage of the process we're gonna talk about.
You're gonna get to know them.
Right.
You're basically. Gonna get to know
them. But let's be real.
Okay.
Like, your chances of playing with six total strangers more than a couple times in your entire diplomacy career. Not that big.
Yeah.
You're
almost, at least you're face-to-face diplomacy crew.
You're face-to-face.
There are some online
Thank
people
you.
Who prefer it that way, which is fine. We'll touch on that too. But
you're probably, it's a small community. You're probably going to meet some of the same people more than once.
Yeah. And when you are playing the same people more than once, a mistake that I see people make is that they don't remember what happened last time. Not to say... Oh, you stabbed me last time, so I'm going to attack you this time. That's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm
right.
saying, remember, like, creating a little library in your head, a little index of what type of person, what type of player your opponent is. What I want to talk about specifically is kind of the things that it's important to look for in an opponent. You know, the sometimes people focus on the wrong things, like, you know, this guy's a jerk or this guy's a
right.
nice guy. Or,
it's not about revenge.
It's not about revenge, and it's not about, there's a lot of things that it's not about, but there are some characteristics that if you spot that somebody played like that one time, he's likely to do it again.
Right.
And that's what we want to focus on this time. So learning your opponent's tendencies.
Or just identifying tendencies that are important to remember.
Right.
You know, I think that's what we're gonna try and focus on. We're gonna talk about a little bit, sort of like in the house game context, in the in the tournament context, and then sort of in a little bit in the online.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just
Well, it happens online too. I mean, there's
absolutely.
A lot of people who play each other a lot online, and it's sort of a different process to pick it out in an online game because I think the fundamentals apply either way. Let's get into a couple.
Examples.
Concrete, yeah.
Sure.
The first one that came to mind, of course, is the sort of Care Bear cutthroat thing. Is your opponent a quote alliance player, or is he a quote stabber?
Right.
This one's not easy to define because every diplomacy player is a little bit of both.
Right, there's a spectrum. But
mm-hmm.
there's definitely people that are on one side of the spectrum. They lean one way, they lean another, they just have a pattern of behavior that... Because what you're trying to do, and I think this is... I should have mentioned this earlier. What you're trying to do is, as much as possible, predict.
Yeah.
Because the game does not allow a lot of prediction in just... It tries to remove a lot of that—the simultaneous movement and the the you know ability to lie and cheat and whatever.
Yeah.
That it tries to make that as make it your interactions as opaque as possible. And you're trying to edge that back a little bit and predict the behavior that other people are going to do or likely to do,
yep.
so that you can take the greatest advantage of that.
So this is something to try and learn about everyone that you think you might ever play against again.
Right.
Is how reliable of an ally are they? I'll give you an extreme example that just, didn't even have this in my notes, but it just popped into my head. We used to have a guy in our local hobby around here, and also somewhat in the tournament hobby, named Ken Lemire.
Oh, Ken.
Ken. I'd love to have him on the show someday.
I would if I could find him.
Yeah, he's fallen off the face of the earth. But Ken Lemire, when I first came into the hobby, was the guy that everybody knew that he was such an extreme alliance player. Like, not like he allied with everybody, but he would, like, find somebody every game
right. That
was Ken's real ally.
Yeah.
And Ken was really good at diplomacy. This is the other part of it. He's like, he never made mistakes, or he rarely made mistakes. He was really talented. And if Ken had decided that you were his real ally, then Ken would never cover a center. He would, like, share dots with you. You could do whatever you wanted.
Right.
Like, whatever made your alliance advance is what Ken wanted. Right. Ken didn't even ever really want a solo.
He didn't want to win.
No.
That was the other half of it. He wanted to dominate.
Yes.
But he did not want to win.
Yes. And so, the glorious game for Ken, like, his way of winning would be to just find, like, one other person on the board, maybe two other people on the board, and just cream everyone else by showing complete disregard for his own centers. And, you know, you could, if you were Ken's chosen ally, you could, I suppose, stab Ken in solo.
You could try.
You could try.
And he usually...
But fact number one is that Ken was really good, right. and he would find a way to, like, take you down with him if you ever decided to do that. And thing number two was the fact that once you did that, you'd never be Ken's choice again.
Right.
Ever.
And that's the other half of it. Well, we're going to get into that in a second.
Yeah.
So the games devolved into trying to become Ken's real ally.
Right. People
which
would
was
fight.
Quite funny.
Yeah, exactly. And people, you know, and it was like, how do I charm Ken? How do I convince Ken to be... So that's an example of somebody that if you didn't know Ken from Adam, just sitting down on the board, like, you would be missing a huge asset in the game. You would be missing, like, if everybody else knew how Ken played and you didn't know, you were at a huge deficit. Huge deficit. And so that, knowing that about Ken, like, it not only changed your game, but it would change everybody's game as the whole thing would just be like, how do I please Ken?
Yeah, so what can I do? What gifts can I put at the feet of the master?
Exactly.
Right.
So that's an extreme example of what we're talking about, but that's knowing that a player is an extreme allied player.
Right. And so the other half of that is, you know, someone that is, we have a lot of words for it. Let's just be as extreme as possible. The worst thing you can kind of say is that somebody's a dot grabber.
Sure.
And that's, you know, we've used the term before, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with it, but that's someone who, any available open supply center, you know, regardless of the alliance structure that's around them, if it's open to them and they can take it, they take it.
Yep. Yep. You're sort of allies, and then sometimes they'll, you know, try and talk their way right back out of it again and say, hey, I took your dot, but hey, I still want to work together and blah, blah, blah,
and
blah.
There are a few people that are true, you know, to the core dot grabbers.
Yeah, and they're not very good at the game, obviously,
right.
Because people learn even people who have never played them before learn quickly within a game.
Right.
This guy's just grabbing every dot, he lies every turn, and that guy usually gets killed. So,
usually. There are some people that make it work.
Yep.
And I'm sure we can come up with a short list of people that we've met that do that. I think I want to be clear, I'm not judging the playstyle. That's not what this episode is about. Mm-hmm. This episode is about identifying behavior, not like, not telling you which one is better or which one is worse or what you should be doing. Well, this episode and this power play is about identifying these behaviors, filing them away, and using them to your advantage.
Mm-hmm. So this is something to track game to game.
Right.
It is a guy, and the more, I mean, we've given some sort of extreme examples on both sides of that one, but more typically what you'll be dealing with is, all right, is a guy more likely... And I keep saying guy, but, you know, guy or woman, more likely to, if he's your initial ally, be less like, I mean, want to keep that ally after your initial target is dead.
Right.
This is an important thing to know. So, like, me and Nathan are going to work together to go kill Ken Lemire, which would be insane, but that's what we're going to do.
Sometimes
for purposes of this example. after Ken is pretty much dead or broken and there's not really any more dots to get, there's the people who are likely to want to then turn on you.
Right.
Because you're closest. And then there's the people that are likely to go, this alliance is going great. Who do we kill next?
Right. And so that's really the question. Like, is this a person that has an alliance for a discrete goal, or do they make alliances for, like, game long or mm-hmm. close to it?
Mm-hmm.
Or at least, like, game phase long, such as, like, you know, mid game or yeah. end game or something.
Yeah, this won't usually tell you anything in spring of 01, except no. in the more extreme cases, like usually, or fall of 01. You know, it usually doesn't tell you what his initial play is going to be.
Yeah.
But it'll tell you that if you tell him the truth for a couple of years, does that build something?
Right.
You know, does it, or is he kind of the kind of person that's like, oh, that was nice. You told me the truth. Anyway, I'm right. killing now. Yeah.
Right. And that kind of that gets into a little bit more of a nuance, and mm-hmm. you can start identifying people that react well to you telling them the truth.
Yeah.
There are some people that's very, very important to them.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not it advances the purposes of either side of the alliance, whether or not it is detrimental to the person that was lied to or not,
mm-hmm.
There are people that feel that if you're going to lie to me, I do not want to work with you.
Yeah.
So you need to identify people like who have specific needs like
yeah.
that. Like if someone has that particular quirk, there's a couple of other ones out there. Like
yeah.
the lying one is one. There are other people that they just need to be talked to for a significant amount of time.
Yep.
And
then there's the ones that sort of take an agreement seriously, which is right. kind of another subset of that just kind of popped in my head. In other words, if you say, all right, let's just never move to Galatia, and you don't,
yeah.
he never will either.
Right.
And he'll mention it years later. He'll say, well, we had an agreement.
Right.
We said in the spring of 01 that we were never going to move to Galatia. That's an important piece of information to know about an alliance player. Is there a guy that you can just say, hey, let's be allies? And in his head, if he says okay to that, then you're allies until yeah. further notice.
And I think that absolutely happens. And, mm-hmm. It reminds me of something that we're going to talk about a little bit later
yeah.
Regarding what it is that, how to set up particular situations just for you personally, like whatever, setting up little tests. And we'll talk about this in like...
Okay. Well, go ahead while you're on it.
Well, I don't want to forget the other thing I was going to say.
Right.
There are ways I will forget about either one, so I'm just going to go with it. So... there are things, once you start this library, right? Let's yeah. say you're a brand new player, or maybe you're an experienced player, you've been playing for years, and you're just going to be a little bit more strategic or a little mm-hmm. bit more organized about how you're going to do this. Find different ways to efficiently get out these tells, these behaviors. So, personally, for an example, one thing that I like to do is when I'm playing Italy, I like to go to France and say, you know what, I'm not interested in the Gulf of Lyon, and I'm just never going to go there until you go there. And just throw that out there.
Right.
So I can, and when you learn a lot about the French at that point,
right.
about how they deal with that. And the same thing with Galatia, the same thing with the Black Sea, the same thing with the English Channel. And like when you create these situations, finding out how they react to it
yes.
is a huge, you know, even if you don't care about the Gulf of Lyon,
yeah.
you're learning a lot about how that person reacts to yeah. that request and how that person gets around it or abides by it.
Yeah.
So you want to try and create these situations where you can try and get this information as quickly as possible.
That's a good call, actually, because I can imagine the kind of player who would go, all right, and that would like mean a lot to them. Like
right. yeah,
that would clearly be like an establishment of principle. And then like if you came and said that to me, I'd be like,
I'm going there right now. Or you know, because you can find people that are just like, you can't tell me what to do. I'm
yeah.
like, go there right now, even if it's terrible for me.
Yeah.
Like, but you will learn a lot. So you want to make sure that you're taking the time
yeah.
to create situations where you can learn this stuff as quickly as possible, because you know you're trying to win this game.
Mm-hmm.
But like we said earlier, the chances that you're going to play with these people again. They're probably above 50%.
Yeah.
Like, it's a small world.
Yeah.
Especially if you're playing a house game. Like, you're going to probably meet with the same group 12, 15, 20 people all the time. So it's good to know how they react to things.
Yeah.
The other half of what I was going to say, I'm sorry, I'm taking up too much time,
Go.
There's sort of we're talking about, you had a great example of Galatia and how that agreement can really solidify an alliance.
Yeah.
Those are good tells. Those are good things to know. I'm use the word tells. Please don't.
Yeah.
We'll talk specifically about what tells are in diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And I'm just ignore what I'm saying. I mean behaviors. There's another side to it. You want to know if you violate that agreement, how that person is going to react.
Right. Some people will declare war on you from that moment forward because you violated the agreement. Some people go, all right, I know we had a deal, but I get why you did that. Now let's talk about this.
The same catalog that you're making of people's mm-hmm. behaviors and how they ally with people or don't ally, mm-hmm. you want to know how they react mm-hmm. when was, you know, air quote, wronged or yep. somehow violated.
Something doesn't go their way.
You, okay. That is really important to know because you're going to want to find people that have a similar style than you.
Yep.
And you're not going to want to really deal long-term with people that can't handle renegotiation of previous agreements.
Yep. And again, this is, you know, it might sound like we're talking about this is just stuff you figure out during a game. It is, but the fact is as you start to index this stuff, it can affect your decision-making process right away when you see this guy right. again, because then you whatever plan you're making right away, right. you can take all this stuff into account.
Well, and you'll start to see indications of, because the fact of the matter is, the spectrum of behavior we're talking about mm-hmm. here is really narrow. Mm-hmm. And once you start, you know, learning to identify these behaviors and these reactions and how they how parents deal with it, you can identify that same behavior in other people right. early on.
Right.
So you want to be particularly...
You can start to learn the types right. a little bit.
Okay, so I know sure. how to deal with you now.
I know I make poker metaphors and I have no idea on this show all the yeah. time, but there's, like, basically there's, I mean, really only, like, four kinds of poker player, and figuring out which one of those fight, you know, there's like the guys that play too many hands and play them passively, the guys that play too many hands and play them aggressively, the guys that play not very many hands and play them passively, and the guys who play not very many hands and play them aggressively. You know, like, it's basically yeah. like almost every poker player is somewhere in that continuum, and if you sit down at a poker table and go, okay, he's that guy, he's that guy, he's that guy, he's that guy, like, you start winning more. Right. You just do. So...
And it's the same thing here.
Exact same thing. Like, just a few characteristics of that indexing them a little bit and just keeping them in mind will help your game a lot. Finishing up on the alliance versus savvy.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
One thing to make clear is the people that aren't these alliance players who will just sort of declare an alliance, that doesn't mean you should never be their ally.
Oh, yeah.
It just means that when you are their ally, you have to deal with them a little differently. You just have to be aware that they're working for you, with you, for mutual gain, and if you give them that opportunity, they'll take it. These people can be great allies because they're usually aggressive players, too. And so if you get them and you come up with a good plan and you say, we're going to go kill Turkey and we're going to go kill him right now, and he's on board for it, and you don't give him an opportunity to deviate from his plan, then a lot of times you can move faster.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
It just don't let him get out of hand. That's
right.
Like
just, you know, there's a type of player that when Italy and Austria attack Turkey, you leave an army in Trieste.
Exactly.
That's what you do.
Exactly. And it's fine, and it doesn't make them a bad ally. It can occasionally be sort of a drag because it's like you have to leave too much of your stuff behind. But on the flip side, that guy can be a good ally.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to make sure he has something more profitable to do than attack you.
Right.
So
he's probably still going to attack you anyway. Being able to react to these things just sort of dictates your play a little bit to your best advantage. Yeah. And that's really what we're all about here.
Yeah. So finishing up on that continuum, another one, unless you got anything else on the, okay. Another one, that we were thinking about is sort of the conservative versus aggressive, which is another, I mean, it's a little different. It's sometimes there's some of that in common, but
they're not necessarily. Yeah, I think it's important to say that these are not one and the same. This is a different continuum.
Yeah.
You can have conservative, savvy players easily.
Yeah, the conservative player, I'd say, is not one to get overextended. One who's happy if he's growing one per year.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah,
you know, as long as, you know, we'll tend not to suddenly flip and go do something else.
So they're reliable, but they also, I mean, you know, you have to know that if you have a fairly conservative player in your theater, if you need to move quickly to create a stalemate line, to react to someone that has, let's say somebody on the other side, the balance is off, and they just explode and they start blowing up, the conservative player is not going to be able to react very quickly to that.
Or want to.
So, you know, not want to expose themselves to, sometimes you just have to like say, look guys, we gotta do something about this. And your centers, me taking your centers just doesn't matter right now. And those, and being able to identify the players that are a little more conservative they're going to push back fairly aggressively on that. That's important to know. Because it's going to, you don't want to waste the 2 game years that it takes to really discover that they're not, whatever they're saying, they're not actually going to do it. You don't have that kind of time. So knowing ahead of time is important.
Flip side of that, of course, aggressive players, the opposite. They'll tend to turn on a dime. They'll tend to try riskier plays.
Right.
They'll tend to kind of go for the far dot and then come back for the close dot when it suits them.
And they'll try. They'll try interesting things. I don't want to say interesting because that implies that is a positive connotation. They'll try. They'll try things that are not necessarily tried and true. You know, like they like
to surprise for surprise's sake. Sometimes,
exactly. So sometimes, you know, you'll hear this a lot. I don't think he'll see this coming. I'm going to do this thing.
Right.
That's the classic aggressive player line. It's sort of like, well, I don't think they're going to see this coming.
Conservative versus aggressive is a good thing to know for an ally, a great thing to know for an enemy.
Yeah.
Because then you can kind of start to guess their moves. If you're just like, it's fall, so he's going to go for the dot because he's a conservative player.
Yep. Or he's going to cover that. I know he's going to cover
the dot. He's that guy.
Yeah.
The aggressive player might gamble the dot to try and get better position, even if it's fall.
So, you know, in those situations where you think, oh, it's a coin flip, it can be either 50-50, I could go here or go there. If you know the player's, this style of player, that coin flip is suddenly weighted. It's a 75% chance he's going to cover this. It makes the most sense for me to take this move.
Yep.
So that's another good spectrum to really look at.
Yeah. So let's see. One other one that I thought of, I guess, that has to do, it's sort of related. It has to do with the tactics.
Okay.
If you're, you know, aggressive versus conservative can sometimes help you guess their moves. Also, better than you or worse than you.
Tactically.
Also a good thing to know. It might help you decide who you're attacking and who you're not.
Not how you defend. I mean, if the person is better at tactics than you are, you're just going to have to just roll with that.
You're going
to
be wrong.
But to know, like, there are just people that are much better at tactics, and it doesn't matter how many games I play. There are the people in the world that are just going to see deeper or see things I don't see quickly enough.
And sometimes it's not just a binary, like, better or worse. Right. It's like a matchups thing. Right. There's, like, people I can outguess every time and people who can outguess me every time. And I don't necessarily think the people I can outguess every time are all worse players than me.
Right. You're right. It's a good situation.
They're in my head. I'm in theirs. You know,
whatever. Well, because everyone else is doing this. You know, everyone else is learning your behaviors and how you operate. And there are just, you'll run into people who just know you well enough, they're like, yep, you're going to do that, and you know, despite knowing that they know, you can't help it.
Yep.
So it's good to identify those people that are consistently out-guessing you, or you can consistently, you're in their head, you know what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. And those poor people, you attack them again. They're like, why do you always attack me? Do you not like me?
I always win.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
Another one I thought of just real quick, and then we got to move on to other stuff.
I think there's another side of this. There's tactics and diplomacy. There are people that, you know, that you will identify
that are
just persuasive, they tend to be, they have more than most diplomacy players, obviously, they have the charisma that they're able to connect with people. But there are some people that really have it in spades, and those people you need to know.
Mm-hmm.
For a good example is you know, when they walk over with a newer player or a player they haven't, like, they're good with the people that have never played before, the strangers of the board, and they just take them under their wing, and every single time they play them like a fiddle, not necessarily in a bad way, but they have just, they're able to do that. So knowing, you know, if this person gets to talk to that person, that person's gone, and they will never be my ally.
When your ally is the new player, and all of a sudden you realize your ally is talking to that guy, look out for the
stage. Exactly. You're like, oh no. But really knowing, like, in
get
a theater,
away from my newbie.
Like a Western triple. If there's a guy that you know is always gonna get the ally over you, and you're Germany, and that there's a person in France you're both gonna vie for, knowing that you're probably gonna be at the on the wrong side of that is really important to know. It's gonna change how you play.
Yeah, definitely. That's a good call. I didn't even think of that one. The only other one I wanted to mention was sort of like the BSer / time waster.
That's just, I like these guys.
Yeah, just know one thing to index is sometimes people will actually just talk to you just to take up your time and keep you from talking to other people that you need to be talking to. Know which people those are.
Yeah.
And remember, so you can just say, I'm sorry, Nathan, I need to go talk to this guy now, and he's not going to be offended because all he was trying to do was waste your time anyway.
Well, he might pretend to be offended, but it's part of, it's an off-board, and I think that's a subtle distinction, but this is, you know, there's a lot of off-board behavior that happens. I mean, there's above-board, you know, taunting, you know, little, like, you know, trash-talking, but this one's subtler, and it takes a little while to identify, but once you do, and you can identify that person doing it, you're going to save yourself a lot of time by going, out, because he's not going to say, she's not going to say anything to you that actually matters.
Yeah. I can remember a game where I literally lost an entire season to a guy who had one dot, trying to convince me to, like, help him into his second dot or something. And then I was like, oh my god, the clock. And I realized that I hadn't talked to any of my real allies, and I got totally stabbed.
Right.
It can happen. All right. Well,
so I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we could go on about, like, these personality type things that are there.
We can tell war stories on that.
Yeah, that too. I wanted to flag some of the ones that are, you know, and the reason we're focusing on these characteristics in particular are these are things to look for that will have a real impact on your games. Like, if you can identify, like, a few of those things about the people that you play a lot, you're way ahead of the curve. Other things that we didn't mention, it might just be because we didn't mention them because we weren't thinking about them, but other things that we didn't mention might not be so important.
Right.
As an example, that guy stabbed me last game isn't as important as it sounds.
Yes, yeah, it's really mostly unimportant.
Why did he attack you last game? You know, is what the question is that you need to learn. We always fight is not really, doesn't really tell you anything. Okay, you always fight, but why? What if you wanted to be his ally? How would you approach that?
Because there's going to be times when, you know, other people are attacking you, and you're going to need to try to figure out what's wrong with this guy, and or what's wrong with you and your approach.
Mm-hmm.
And then most of the time, it can be worked out. Sometimes, not so much. There's an animosity, and those I find are really rare.
Yeah.
But I want to pull out and highlight what Eric is saying. I think to distill it down a little bit, revenge is really not that productive.
No,
like, it's not gonna. It doesn't move your game forward at all.
No, and among people who love the game, it's an almost non-existent factor. Unless there was, like, a really, really dirty game that happened right before.
Well, that reminds, I'm sorry to
interrupt. No, go ahead.
Because that reminds me, we go back to Ken Lemire. Because it's the end of that story.
The end of that story is everyone
wanted to be Ken Lemire's ally, remember?
Mm-hmm.
So, one time, somebody just said, this is silly, I'm going to stab him.
Mm-hmm.
And that person got punished by Ken Lemire over and over again.
His vengeance
fivefold. To really to really underscore, like, you don't stab me, I get to pick an ally, and if I pick you, you don't stab me. Yeah. And he just did that for game after game and just, like, ground out.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. That's not necessarily great behavior, but it's really good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, you want to know if your decisions are going to have a lasting impact. I don't like thumbs up that behavior. I don't
know
particularly good.
No, but the point is, unless it's Ken,
right?
Like most people,
very extreme example.
Yeah, most people who play the game sort of get in the head, like are able to wipe the slate clean most of the time, and if you find that you had a rocky start with the same player two games in a row, it might not be the second one might not be the result of what happened in the first one. The second one might be because you're approaching him wrong,
right,
both times. And that's the important thing to know.
I said we were going to talk a little bit about online, and this will wrap up with this. I think we've heard from, you know, interviewed online people. We've definitely gotten feedback on and heard from the online community that it's hard to break into, quote unquote, break into the tournament or face-to-face community, because there's this perception that there's these friendships that are really, you know, they're already like pre-made alliances, which is something, you know, pre-alliances or auto-alliances I've heard for years and years and years and years.
Yeah.
And I think that this is a good time to really just, again, highlight from my point of view, and I think from most tournament player point of view, those friendships are really, they're not significant in on the board. And frankly, you know, if you meet somebody at the bar and, you know, pre-tournament, and you like are chummy with them and you buy them a couple of beers, you know, if I'm on the receiving end of that, and I, you know, that's great, but it's not going to translate for me onto the board, or like I'm going to treat you better. That's the weakest kind of alliance there is.
Definitely.
Meeting somebody and being friendly.
In fact, it's almost a running joke. I'll say that as a long-time tournament goer. Like you'll get together with the people the night before, like your buddies who have been to a lot of tournaments before, and I'll go, man, Nathan, tomorrow if you and me are on a board together, we're just gonna roll, and it never happens
that way.
Even if you are right next to each other on the board, you're like, remember last night when we were just gonna roll? Oh yeah, yeah. And then it totally like
it's almost a little bit funny not to do it. And and as you probably as anybody who's listened to the show, you know that it's the board that dictates it. It's not what you've arranged before. Beforehand. But, you know, that I think it's important. My personal caveat, if you do that to me and you're like, oh, we're going to be friendly, and I stab you and you get mad about it, we're probably not going to be friends, because my actual diplomacy friends are going to be able to take the fact that, you know, occasionally I'm just going to have to, you know, break this off in you because this is so that's the game.
And I bought Nathan 5 drinks and he took 5 of my dots.
But I mean that, and I think that I'm being extreme about it, but I think that's true.
Yeah.
You're not going to find a lot of really close diplomacy, face-to-face diplomacy people that are, you know, good friends that have never stabbed each other ever. Those people do not exist because you can't. You can't really enjoy the game and never attack your best friend.
I can think of maybe like two pairs that I've known in the tournament scene where it's like panic mode when those guys are on a board together because they work so well together. Like
I think even those people, they stab each other occasionally.
And they stab each other occasionally, and it's usually like an epic game when they finally do. You know, it kind of changes things up. But I mean, I can think of like a couple of pairs, but my point that I was going to illustrate there is that the rest of the tournament scene knows that. Like, if you're on that board, you'll hear about it in the first 2 minutes.
Right.
I promise you. Like, if you've never met any of these people before, and this is your very first tournament before, and you're on a board with two of the guys that are well-known for working well together, all other four people on the board are going to tell you that and instruct you that you need to kick their butts as soon as possible.
And present you with a variety of scenarios to just undo that particular danger.
Yeah.
It's another thing, another behavior, another, you know, prediction that you can do that will influence your game.
Which brings me to sort of like how I kind of want to like tie all this together, because the reason we sort of jumped from types of people and learning types of people to like what the tournament scene is and how people deal with each other as friends is because that's not what's happening.
Right.
What's happening is that when you go to a tournament or you go to like a house game with people who have played a lot before, you might feel like you just got your butt kicked by a bunch of guys who are all friends. What you just got is people who know a lot about each other's tendencies and so have a lot of shortcuts.
Right.
And they're not just shortcuts to getting to work with somebody else. They're also shortcuts for undoing someone else. Like these people who have played a lot together know each other's weaknesses too. In fact, a ton of, you know, tournament games particularly, a ton of them, one of the first things that happens is that players who don't know each other as well kind of try and swap gossip about the other players. Like a lot of the spring 1901 negotiations are played with this guy before. Yeah, what's he like?
Yeah.
What's he do? Aggressive, conservative, good alliance player?
I ask every time.
Me too.
Yeah. Whatever information I can get, like, you want to be as efficient about that as possible.
Mm-hmm. Or you ask, hey, what, you know, have you worked with this guy a lot? You know, like, have you played him before? Oh, yeah. Did you guys work well together?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
okay. Or offer up your own. Have you played with him? Here's my experience.
Yep.
You know, and...
It's a way to build trust, and it's also a way of... And frankly, that happens before the game, after the games, too. Now, if that seems unfair, that all of these people have this sort of library... Well, if that seems unfair, then you're kind of a different kind of person than I am, I think.
Yeah.
Because to me, like, I can remember when I first started going to tournaments, discovering that sort of that's how it was. Oh, all these guys have played each other before, and so they know all this stuff about each other.
Yeah.
I was like, I want to know that, too. I want to figure that out, too. Like, to me, that struck me as just sort of part of the game. And
it is. And here's the other advantage.
Mm-hmm.
When no one knows who you are, when you're not an entry in anybody's library, wow, do you have an advantage?
Yeah. No question.
Because everyone's relying on their library, and you're not fitting, it takes time to, you know, round out what you do.
And I am not joking when I say this. I have so many times seen a guy who shows up, and here it is, shows up, seems like a nice dude, gets along with people, seems to be having a good time, plays a game, doesn't do anything insane, doesn't, like, act extremely strangely, plays decently, you know, does well, and by the end of the tournament, that's the guy that everyone wants to be the ally of.
Yeah.
That's the guy, because they're like, whoa, it's a new guy who knows right. what's up and knows what he's doing, and he does, you know, it's his t-shirt fits, and he doesn't smell bad, and just, you know, like, this is so cool. And you turn into the one that everyone is like, I want to see how this works.
You're the flavor of the week.
Yeah.
Because they're just translating that strength I just talked about into their alliance.
Exactly.
People don't know how to react to that, to the new person yet. It takes like a year, 2 years in the tournament scene at least.
Yeah.
If you're doing a house thing, it's going to be a totally different timeline. Yeah. And they're going to learn pretty quick.
Yeah. But we've been on tournaments too long.
Yeah,
right.
But exactly. You know, it just depends on where you are. But like for a while, people don't know how to react to that person, and that can be a great advantage. I mean,
yeah.
That's why, you know, all the people that are winning tournaments, you know, they tend to be a two or three people in a year that are new, and mm-hmm. they are up at the top of the charts until everybody gets the memo, mm-hmm. and then, you know, we drag them back
into our muck.
Into our muck of despair.
We've all cut score long enough where we're like, just like,
and you're done!
Yeah, and we've actually talked about that in a slightly different context before, of just, you know, like, people, when you're winning too much, they figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, like, you do well for a while, and then they're like, wait a minute,
wait
this
a minute.
Eric Mead guy lies all the time. Let's, you know, yeah, and when someone's winning too much, that happens. It really does. People start to say, oh, well, you know how you beat Andy Bartoloni? You do this.
Right.
And people are like, ooh, I'll try that next time. And all part of the game,
a fun part of the game, honestly.
Yeah, definitely. It just makes what is already a social game into something more social,
right.
and it doesn't mean that you have to do all that. It just means you're missing out on part of the game if you don't.
Right.
You know.
Well, let's ask Brian Sheldon about it.
You're ready, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm ready to talk to Brian Sheldon. I want to hear that Texas twang.
Yeah, that New York, Texas.
It's gonna be weird. It's not. It's gonna be a
Vermont.
Texas, Vermont.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's got a cowboy hat sometimes.
First question for Brian: where the hell are you from? After this,
today's guest is
wanted to be introduced as undistinguished journeyman of diplomacy, Brian Sheldon, but I think he deserves a little better than that.
In other words, what you're saying is we vetoed that request.
Yeah,
we just sort of flat out said, no, you can't say undistinguished. I think he needs like a baronship or at least a sir.
Yeoman Brian Sheldon via Skype in Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
Our first question for you is, why is it that you think you're so bad at diplomacy?
Because I played with you and you're not.
Well, because if you look at, I've been to a lot of tournaments, like in lots of different places, and almost every time I come in, like at the 33rd percentile, so no higher, no lower, you know, so it's,
So depending on how big,
yeah. I play with people like Nathan, like you know Chris Martin and you know Andy Barlone, and these guys, and they treat me with respect as a player, and then they kick my butt.
So, yeah. I see. Okay.
And every time I play with Eric, he's solo. So I mean, what does that say?
Okay. No. You know, everything before I was ready to argue with, but that last one. Okay. Yeah. That might be an indicator. That might be an indicator of a problem.
Could be.
No, I've never found that with it.
Well, I mean, obviously Brian's being a little bit modest. He's had some tournament success, and he knows.
Oh, yeah.
And we had him on today because we specifically were interested in talking about the subject that we had on this episode. Yeah. I was trying to think of who I know that I've had fun conversations about these subjects with before.
And let's be fair, productive conversations.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's always a little bit of trash talking after tournament. I mean, that's part of the, or any event, you know, or a house game, you always kind of rehash it, right?
Yeah.
And so there's those occasions when you have that rehash with people and it's, you know, you're just talking trash. You're just like, oh, that guy sucked. Did you see, you know, he smelled bad or he looked like, you know, Genghis Khan or with bad hair.
So I couldn't work with him.
Right. Yeah, that's why. But I recall having conversations with Brian that are a little bit more, let's dig a little deeper. Why? Like, why didn't this work? And like, we have like, you know, productive conversation. So I think that's one of the reasons that we both thought of Brian.
Yeah. And let's start at house games because I know Brian and I have been to a lot of the same.
You organized them, didn't you?
We used to actually organize a few of them when we both lived in New York at the same time and stuff. Subject, Brian, I think I told you a little bit about it, was when you're playing the same people again and again. And you mentioned, like, what's it important to learn about them? You mentioned, like, those times you play with Nathan or Chris Martin or Andy Bartoloni, and you kind of develop a profile of these people that you've played multiple times. Go ahead and just kind of, I don't know what my question is.
Yeah, it's not really a question. I mean, we were talking about it as a library of, like, you remembering people's moves. I mean, sort of like, oh, you want to know somebody who's a stabber or who's an alliance player or who's a this and that. Yeah. I mean, your initial thoughts on, you know, sort of that topic would be just great to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I'm finding, you know, I remember when I first got into the tournament hobby and I would go and I'd gone to like, you know, three or four tournaments or something. And then I saw someone, I think it was Eddie Brisson, who I'd seen at my first tournament. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him about things that happened on the first board that I was with him. And you know, Eddie Brisson, who's, you know, a legend in the hobby, been playing for, you know, 200-300 years, right?
Okay.
So he doesn't remember every game he's been on.
Yeah.
So I think one of my, whereas I think I still do for the most part. Like it's getting the memory's getting thinner. So mm-hmm. I do remember a lot about what happened, and you can start categorizing, you know, like, you know, I played with Chris. I lived in two different towns that Chris Martin did at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So I played, you know, 100 games with him, you know, and you know that so you learn a couple of rules of thumb, you know, don't give him two centers or, you know, three center stab and a two center with position. I mean, he'll tell you that himself, you know.
He won't take the two, but he'll take the three. In other words.
Yeah, if you give him a three center stab, he's going to take it.
Okay.
You know, or two centers in position, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like when you play with when you play with Eric Mead, the newbies are on his, you know, the newbies are between you and him, you're going to lose.
Right. That, you know, it's funny you mentioned that because it was a specific thing that I wanted to call out. There are those people, and then with the newer players, and you're like, oh, I better. That's going to be a problem. I know if Eric gets to those people. So it's funny that you mentioned that.
Good. Am I interrupting here? Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a bunch of obvious diplomacy skills that you need to have, you know, like tactics and strategy and negotiating, right? And then there are more specific skills that that you kind of know that people are better or worse at, like, you know, like, for example, Eric is very good at newbie farming, as we say, you know, and I'm not very good at that, right? So I know that. So if I can pick off an experienced player between Eric and I, you know, well, he gets a newbie, you know, hopefully we'll do better, you know, so, that kind of thing. There's also some players that are, are kind of goldfish, you know what I mean? Meaning, and what I mean by that is that they are, will agree to almost anything, but the one that they agree to last will win, so you need to get them last.
We didn't talk about that one. So good. That's a classic.
That's a classic.
Yes. And then there are also some very volatile players. Actually, this is kind of not my best skill as a diplomacy player, where if you can piss them off, their game will deteriorate quickly. Yeah, so that's a great way to get me off my game, is to kind of, treat me like I'm stupid, and then suddenly I'll blow up, and suddenly my orders don't make sense anymore. Will make less sense.
Right. No, and people will exploit that kind of thing, and then another one that we didn't talk about before that just occurred to me is sort of the opposite of that, where if you're simply just nice to somebody the entire game, but you know that they're the sort of person that will flip out. At a certain point, like, if you're nice and honest with a guy the entire game, he'll sometimes get mad at somebody else and then throw his dots to you.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. That's a good little one to have on file with the people that you play with a lot house games.
Yeah, tournaments. It's interesting, pertaining to Nathan's original question, I think, and that he was, I mean, what I think Nathan was trying to say is what kinds of people have you met in the hobby, and, you know, and how do you work with or against them, you know, based on categories? And I'm thinking, you know, and every time we think of a category here, what I'm doing in my head is I'm thinking of a list of people that applies to.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean? So, and maybe that's just how I play. I mean, I'm at a huge disadvantage when I go to a tournament and I'm on a board with five strangers. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, and in fact, that's how I often opening negotiations at a tournament is, you know, I'll go up to, a person and say, well, hey, I only know Nathan on this board, you know, and here's my opinion of Nathan, you know, and what do you think of this person? What's he play like, you know, things like that. So it's a good icebreaker, you know, like get you to know people, and maybe you get some inside information. Like if you come to a tournament in Seattle and there are all these local players that you all play with, mm-hmm. all the time, or at WDC this year in Chicago, it was like crawling with Chicago players who I hadn't met, you know, but I had mutual friends, and you could ask about them, and you could say, you know, that, how does this person play, and, you know, does they, you know, are they aggressive or, you know, are they aggressive or conservative,
exactly.
Or, you know.
Yeah, it's important.
The lingo, that's a huge thing too. You know, if you, there's, you know, like, there's a huge, there's a tournament lingo that you guys, I mean, that you guys talk, or table talk, I think you call it around here, right?
You mean just sort of the local, the way that the local people, if you're a traveling player, the way that the local people refer to things might be a little different place to place, and it helps to learn, is that?
I do say that. I mean, I think that there is a traveling hobby set of jargon, right? And then there's, you know, and it intersects, you know, I'm picturing a Venn diagram that overlaps, or, you know, that mostly overlaps but sometimes doesn't. And, mm-hmm. and that in the, I mean, that's actually very important to about a bit in local customs as to what's normal and what's not, you know, like if you have, it's like when you play in France, opening north is Russia is not, you know, is like 40-60% of the time kind of thing, whereas that almost never happens in the U.S. I love to open north, but, you know, not so successfully necessarily. But,
right, I do too, but we've talked, argued about that before, but you're just, as you're talking there, I've had the experience before of going and playing with some strangers and having them tell me, Turkey usually gets Greece in 1901 in our games. And just being like, oh.
So why should be Turkey then?
So, yeah, exactly. I didn't want to step on any toes here as Austria. I just was going to try for it. Am I declaring war here? Because, there are those things.
Like, yeah.
house game to house game,
right?
If you travel, with
right, or, running. or even if I'm playing with the two of you guys, experienced tournament players, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm England to your Russia, and I can go up to y'all and say yeah, but I'm going to take it with a fleet, and you'd be like, well, okay, you're not happy with it, but that's fine, and that's our whole conversation, right?
Whereas sure.
when someone hasn't had anyone explain to them before or played in such a way that, by the way, you realize that I put a fleet there and I can't go any further, and it's kind of, yes, I've taken it, but it doesn't, but for some people that, even if that makes sense in our little clique of jargon, right, it may not make sense in their world, and you know what? It's diplomacy. That's what, you can't, it doesn't matter what you think what matters. it matters what the person you're negotiating with thinks matters.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was just thinking the reverse of that is that when you are playing with a group of people who you are sort of familiar with the customs, you do know what the expected interactions are going to be. You can start trying some weirder stuff. Because right. you can kind of go second level and just go, well, nobody ever, if the Italian opens to Munich, to Tyrolia, he never actually goes for Munich. We just don't do that around here. And then that's your time to do it because that everybody thinks it's a dumb play or what, you can try some strange openings from time to time if you're familiar with all the people around you.
I don't know if I'm supposed to get into war stories here or not, but I remember driving down to D.C. when I lived in New York with Chris Martin and Graham Woodring, mm-hmm. and we talked in the car about the Conocrats freakout.
I was with you, too. I know exactly the story, but we'll keep it short, but we'll go there, yeah.
Long story short, it's a very obscure opening where the Italian opens to Tyrolia, which is why I thought of this, and then, the Italian opens to Piedmont and Venice, and the German opens to Tyrolia,
yep.
and then the Italian dislodges Munich, and in the fall, and the German should have his choice of which Austrian center to retreat to.
Right.
And we talked about it being being really fun, and it would be a great time to do it because it was a game with very low stakes. It was just fun, and all people that we knew were the New Yorkers or Washington people.
Mm-hmm.
And then in our second game, Graham and I were Italy and Germany. And we didn't even talk about anything, and we just went. I went out negotiating as if we were going to do that. And he came and said, "Are we going to do that, or are we going to do it?" And I said, "Oh, I've been negotiating for the freakout." And he's like, "Okay, fine." So it was a great chance to do something fun that no one expected and hadn't seen.
Because you knew you had the person next to you that would just be like, "Yeah, let's do it." And you guys were talking. Yeah, that's a good example right there.
Well, and dovetailing into what we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
You had a person. And that person actually wanted to follow through with it,
mm-hmm.
which is one of the things that we talked about before is a little bit about this, and you've touched on it a little bit, Brian. You've talked about what a disadvantage it is to sit on a board with five strangers or whatnot. And so looking to the online hobby who occasionally, braves the waters and makes the leap into a tournament scene, they're often in that spot, as we all were when we started out.
Yep.
We all started out there. Everybody has to cross this Rubicon of like not knowing what the hell is going, any who these people are.
Yep.
And so it's interesting. One of the examples was like, well, there isn't a lot of people talking beforehand and then actually doing it. But here's an example of that actually working out. And it's funny that you have the person that it worked out with is someone that seriously coin toss as to whether or not he actually would have done that.
and this was also, 15 years ago when Graham and I actually could get along.
True.
Yeah, I actually, sort of on a, I don't know if you wanted to respond to Nathan's, but more of what Nathan had to say, but I was just saying, you got me thinking, we didn't talk much in the main part of it about there are certain players that you might know that you can do certain openings with as a more general thing to catalog. The classic one would be the Key Lepanto.
Right.
It comes immediately to mind. There's certain people that you're like, yeah, go ahead and walk through Trieste on your way to Serbia.
Yep.
When you're Austria, other people, no way, you wouldn't even start it,
Who is this person that you would allow to do that?
That's a fair question, actually. Brian Shelton, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Brian Shelton is the answer.
Walk
right
on
there.
Through, because Brian's never stabbed me. No. No.
I never stab anybody for personal gain.
Oh, just to hurt their lives. Yeah.
For attempted personal gain. So.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Whatever. I think it's coming on saying you're an undistinguished diplomacy player and saying, well, I only get in the top third every time. Just sort of. So I don't know if I can really.
Well, I mean, the top third is out of the money, man. I mean, my friends are people, my diplomacy friends are people like y'all that are out of space for diplomacy trophies. You know what I mean? And I think I have four. And for the 120 diplomacy games or tournaments I've been to or something.
True. I'm not winning them anymore. I haven't won them in the last 4 years.
Somehow we started this podcast and we're winning. It's weird.
Yeah, it's weird.
To go back to Nathan's point about going to new tournaments and getting your chops.
Yeah.
I think there's hugely. So there's something to that. I mean, remember my first tournament was. What happened is I played like one or two face-to-face games in college, and no one else wanted to play anymore. So I actually started looking around online, in the early 90s, and found the judges, but didn't figure out how to play, and then found some references to tournaments and said, oh. Well, what the hell? So I think my fourth face-to-face game was at Armada in Denver.
Wow.
The year before WDC. Mm-hmm. It was WDC. And I remember that Manus Hand was holding the tournament because my flight got in late. There were literally 70 people on 10 boards or something, and I'm like driving in from the airport, and I just landed. And like, okay, the board draw's been done. As soon as you arrive, the tournament starts.
Oh Lord!
No pressure.
And then walk up to my table and poof, okay, he's here. The room explodes in noise, and they bring me over to my table, and it's like, okay, you're Italy, and this guy walks up to me and he's like, hi, my name's Eddie Persan, I'm Austria.
Oh, that's lovely. I love that. Did well then. How were your five centers? Were they nice and warm for Eddie?
I never played Italy before, and Italy is very, if you play wishy-washy, you get crushed, and that's kind of what I did. Mm-hmm. But I think I didn't make any monster misorders. I played in a couple of games. I ended up getting in a three-way draw with Dave Maleski later, and perhaps you, Nathan.
Oh, I was at that tournament, so...
Yeah, it was interesting, because everyone assumed that I didn't know what I was doing. I can't imagine why. It was a little accurate. But, you show that you're, negotiating in good faith. I had read up on the jargon and stuff, so I knew what a Lepanto opening was, even if I'd never written the orders before.
Yeah.
I got crushed at that tournament, but... I met some people who realized, oh, okay, this guy is a common player. We're not scared of him, but he's a common player, so he probably won't.
We've hammered away at that subject on this show a few times, and I think it's worth restating your thoughts on it, too. People who show up, don't do anything insane on the boards and seem like sort of nice people off of the boards.
Which would be the majority, by the way.
Just don't prove themselves to be absolutely hopelessly terrible at diplomacy in their first game or two. We'll start finding allies and good ones by the end of that tournament, and certainly in subsequent tournaments, just be nice, be like a regular human being, and you'll do fine. It's not like people at these tournaments are waiting for new guys to gang up on. What they're waiting for is incompetent guys to gang up on. Yeah,
absolutely.
Agree? Disagree?
I mostly agree. Mm-hmm. I do think that there are, the easiest path to a good result is often through a newer player, through familiarity with the non-new player next door, right? Like if you and I drew, if either of the two of you and I drew two countries in the West, and there was, someone who had never been to a tournament before.
You'd totally stand.
You know, it might be, I mean, it's diplomacy, so if you were to stuff us, I might turn around and stab one of you guys, but, you know, there's definitely some people in the hobby that will just target the new people because it's easy, so, sure. You know.
No, no disagreement. It's just what my sort of rant about it is that it has more, the motive has more to do with the fact that it's easier tactically and less to do with the fact that they're strangers.
Well, and I also think the underlying, what we're really saying is you're only new for an extremely short period of time.
Yes.
You're only new for one, maybe two tournaments.
One, maybe two boards.
Right. And like then you're no longer that new guy.
Yes.
As soon as you have a history, you exist. Mm-hmm. As soon as you're in the profile library, as we were saying, of a critical mass of players, which could be like five,
mm-hmm. right.
you're no longer new. Yeah.
One of my, like, my second or third tournament, we went out, you know, as we do, right? We went out to dinner after a round, mm-hmm. and ended up sitting next to Buzz Eddie.
Yep.
Oh.
And I had no idea who he was. And he's like, what he said to me is like, oh, you're Brian Sheldon. You're that guy that came in, you know, that came in, you know, eighth at this tournament in Canada. So, you know, I was like, whoa. So like you said, yeah, after like one tournament, you know, there are going to be people who, know who you are. I mean, it's a small world. There aren't thousands of people that play diplomacy. Yeah. So.
It's a small world, and it's a small world that really rewards the sort of being aware of the people around you aspect of the game, you know, like, because it's diplomacy and that's how you win.
To be frank, we also reward anybody that's willing to come to tournaments. Like, there is like, and I don't mean reward necessarily with results, but you're rewarded in that sort of community.
Yeah.
Like, if you're willing to come to two tournaments a year and you're like, you're around, mm-hmm. like, you're in. Like, you don't have to be an amazing player or anything.
And especially if you do go ahead and go out to that dinner afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
Talk to some new people. It doesn't hurt.
And that's true. You know what? I don't think we say that enough.
Yeah.
Honestly, you know, for anybody who's listening that is maybe just on the fence about going to a tournament at some point, or you've been to a tournament one time and you just didn't have fun, try it again and then just go out afterwards. Even if you know no one. Because there's going to be someone, and it's probably going to be me or, you know, someone else like me, who's just going to go, new guy, hey, come here, let's talk.
Yeah, tell me about your
thing. Tell me about your thing. Yeah, I'm gonna mostly focus on my friends that I've been hanging out with the last, you know, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely, you're not going to sit at the end of the table like a wallflower. You're going to get pulled into the conversation. Yeah. So.
Right.
Give it another whirl. Brian will let you know. Brian will be there.
It's true. And if nothing else, it's not like, I mean, I'm fundamentally a shy guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, hey, here's a bunch of strangers and we're going to go out to dinner and sit at the bar. What am I going to, you know, you think? And I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to talk about with these guys?
Yeah.
And here's the thing. You already have something in common with them. You already, if you've been in one round of the tournaments, you already have war stories to tell, you know, and perhaps, I mean, like, I don't know how many times I've been to a tournament and, you know, we'll end a board and like the seven of us or the five that are still left, will like immediately go get, you know, we'll go get drinks and hang out. And that's how I got to know those people in the hobby, you know, so. So you're like, you know, you start off obviously by saying, well, why did you take Romania? That was stupid, right? You know, or why did you take Romania? I hate you, you know. But then after that, you're like, so what do you do? And you know, and then you're talking about other things as well. Yeah, so it's not all about diplomacy.
I used to spend a lot of time at tournaments and house games. Like when I wouldn't do well on a board, I'd try and catch up with whoever kicked my butt afterwards.
Yeah. Try to figure out why.
Hey, what did I do wrong there? And sometimes you get a good answer to that. Sometimes you get like a political answer to that. It depends on who you're asking and what the circumstances are. But it can be worth a shot, and you can actually learn a lot about the game.
I think this is particularly important at house games because there's less distraction, and you know, often after a tournament, there's like so many boards and people are going off to their friends and other places.
Yeah.
But after a house game, there's always a good opportunity because people generally don't have to like catch a plane or anything or like, you know, get the hell out of there,
mm-hmm.
or necessarily usually there's food around so they don't have to like immediately go eat because they're starving, but it's a good opportunity to really kind of reflect on what you did and talk to the people about, you know, so that you can learn just from a strategic point of view. I also think it's important for the community point of view, as Brian was pointing out, but right. from a strategic, like, because we are a show trying to help people learn how to play diplomacy and be better at it.
Yeah.
Like, there is value to sticking around and having that conversation and not just going, well, shake everybody's hands, peace out, going to get in my car and go home. No, take 20 minutes and figure out why the heck you just got stuffed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's a diplomacy player I'm Facebook friends with, and we have a lot of political arguments, and we're talking past each other in these political arguments, and then finally we like privately came to some talking. And I'm like, I don't understand why we're talking past each other. We have this communication issue, and he's like, I think you're right too. And I'm like, I want to talk to you about how you're getting away with that diplomacy, because what you're doing, because I'm doing right, what you're doing wrong, and vice versa. You know what I mean? So I'm looking forward to seeing him about.
Oh, yeah.
I love that. I know that you're a little short on time, so there was one other subject I wanted to ask you about, some tech stuff that you're working on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
If you don't mind moving topics.
I don't mind.
Okay, you're somebody who's always goofing around with software and apps and various things that like you've called me with a bunch of ideas over the last few months for diplomacy related software stuff. Do you want to talk about anything you're working on now or?
I can talk a little bit. I'm a little bit reluctant to speak about vaporware with people in Seattle. Here's the thing. I have played some online diplomacy not recently, mm-hmm. and I find that there's kind of as a software developer, what I find with these sites is there's some that have a fairly decent user interface, and then doing the adjudication badly. You know, like I was in a game that misadjudicated two things. You know,
wow.
And on the other hand, go ahead.
That kind of can't happen. that's not okay.
No, and then there's the judges, the email judges, right?
Yeah.
Which were written 25 years ago, and they don't make adjudication mistakes.
No, they don't. Right? They're actually.
But on the other hand. How do you get a map of the board? So one of the things that I like to do as a software engineer is take little bits of things that work, right, but not very well together, and make that happen.
Yeah.
And so I kind of have this dream that I'm going to take the old judge software and now that I've looked at it a little bit, clean it up a little bit. And put another interface on top of it, so it's not all email in, email out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that opens up the possibilities of using its adjudication engine on top of either websites or iPhone apps or Android apps or whatever. So it's also interesting to me as a developer because, as I said, I like to take these pieces and pull them together. But this normally ends up being a lot of text processing and stuff. It's not, what I've been saying in interviews for years is if you want me to make it look pretty, I'm not your guy. If you have someone who can make it look pretty but it doesn't work, I am.
Right.
So. It's kind of it gives me this base of the make it work part that I am good at, while I can learn to do some of the front end stuff kind of as a professional development perspective. So it's at this point it's mostly a dream, but there is a judge running on one of my servers that I'm looking at down here at my feed. So it's up and running.
We got an email from a listener that I actually went ahead and forwarded you before this interview. I don't know how carefully you read it, but basically one part of one of his ideas was if, say, every player at a live game had an iPad or something, you could throw in the orders to be adjudicated that way. That's something that would be an application of what you're talking about if people wanted to do it that way, right?
Yeah, I think that would be. I saw that guy's emails. There is. I would love to see. This could be the back end for that. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm a little bit worried about in a tournament setting. You know, because you end up especially with drop dead deadlines, right? You often end up with a you have to write a lot of orders at the last minute.
Yeah.
People are terrible typists, especially on like a small device, because you're not going to be able to have a tournament of 70 people and say bring your iPad.
Yeah.
We have an iPhone and an Android app. And you have to have all 7 people who are able to do that on the board, or you're going to have to
sort of
paper, right?
So, it might be more of a house game thing, at least for a while, until the technology is more universal.
What I think would be awesome for tournaments, right? Is if you build what he's talking about, and you have we often hold these tournaments in conference rooms, right?
Yeah.
So think about when we go to professional conferences or an airport, right? You see like these rows of computer monitors along the wall.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be awesome to just put as soon as you do the board draw, go here, oof, and like screen one as the board draw for screen one, and then and screen two as the board draw for screen two, right? All simultaneously, right? None of this like cheering as you get to board three and moving and awing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Be like fast done. You can still look and have that fun, I guess.
That's a great idea, actually, for a tournament thing.
Yeah.
And in fact, those boards could then have the part of his idea that I really found interesting was the part where you park a little like webcam pointed at a board. And then how much better than conference maps is that? If people can actually get a live stream of the board.
And it doesn't have to be. And a webcam is interesting and easy, isn't it?
Yes.
Because then you don't need if you knew that you could go in, or you could enforce everyone having and willing to not handwrite their orders but send them in on whatever your device is.
Yeah.
Then you have that old flock that you just have like the flock that map up on the screen for each board, up on a big screen, and you stand in one corner and you could both look up and say, no, that's my unit in Romania.
Nathan and I had one other objection to having a computer adjudicated thing at tournaments.
Well, you've already mentioned it. Really.
Which I just wanted to mention it to Brian also. We felt like maybe new players, without getting to see sort of what happened, might occasionally feel like, hey, that's wrong. It got adjudicated wrong, and it would be harder to actually like get the whole board to explain it.
Well, and just like what Brian pointed out, he had an adjudicator that it was misadjudicating.
Yeah,
which is even worse. Like you're putting stuff into a black box and you can't trust it, and then can't explain it to new players.
Us crusty old veterans know that Brian's software is doing it right. Some new player might not.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then that new player might feel like, hey, the tournament is screwing me over because I didn't get Romania when I wanted it. So I kind of like the process of hand adjudicating, just so that you can go, okay, this piece was moving here. Wait, let's go back. Let's read that guy's orders. Okay, now this happened and this support got cut. And then eventually the guy will go, okay, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I did lose Romania. Which is something that you couldn't do with the software. But that's kind of another, I don't know. I'm interested in the prospect of trying to do some sort of like streaming video related stuff as sort of an update to the old conference map, where you forget where all the pieces are. I think that there's some real potential there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of the pieces are there right now, right?
Right.
If you have, and I mean, you could do it with like just with existing software that I know exists, right? I think it's what's it called? A Google Hangout
The
video conferencing, right? Or you could even do it with 6 Skype windows, right? Like we're talking now, right? And you do your negotiation. You do your negotiations with the Google Hangout or Skype, right? You could even run it on a judge game of 15-minute deadlines, and when you're emailing in your orders while you go talk to different people. You don't have to go in different rooms, and then you don't even have to be in the same room.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to be in the same time zone, more importantly, right?
Yeah.
So people are
doing that, and we just don't know about it.
Yeah.
If anyone there is playing Diplomacy on Skype, could you send us an email and tell us you're playing Diplomacy on Skype? Because I'm intrigued.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people talking about it, but I would love to hear about someone who has actually actually tuned. That would be good.
Point is, there's probably a ton of tech stuff that we're just all not thinking about because we've been all doing it the same way for 15 years. And, I'm hoping that there are people younger and more enthusiastic than us that are out, like, sort of innovating on this front, because it's interesting and it could make our hobby a lot bigger and a lot better. But
I mean, that to me is the beauty of the websites like playdiplomacy.com and Yusmeet Santres in France, and in that they are community. Mm-hmm. Right? The judges were running our games like on an automated way on computers 25 years ago. I mean, that's good stuff.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't generating community though.
Yeah.
So, you know, that I think is, that is if our goal is, and I think it, in Lovely's mind is, and I think y'all's is as well, to grow the face-to-face hobby.
Exactly.
That's the thing that I think that those websites are doing that is useful.
Yeah. Well, we're happy to say that we've gotten us within 10 years of modern by podcasting about diplomacy.
Podcasting.
we're a mere 10 years behind now, so yay.
Oh. We're on the cutting edge of 2005.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
All right, buddy. We gotta cut you loose. You've got a dinner party to host for the holidays and stuff.
All right.
Final thoughts, last words?
Last words. That's the last thing.
All right. I think if anyone's listening to this, then what's the card talk thing? Then you've wasted a perfectly good hour, right? But we hope that you spend your next hour by coming to something like WAC and meeting us in person.
WAC, which Brian Shilden will or will not be attending.
We'll probably be attending.
Yes.
That's going to be good.
Yeah.
So if you want
I'm going to Providence.
Yeah, whichever way. Make sure you come next year for the last one.
There you go. Definitely in.
Thank you so much for doing this, Brian. We appreciate it.
Always good to talk to you.
Okay.
All right.
Take care. You have been listening to Diplomacy Cast. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Wasn't it fun?
It was great.
I had a great time.
Yeah, definitely. For Nathan Barnes, I'm Eric Mead. Signing off. We'll talk to you next time.
For Eric Mead, I am a giant 13-foot-tall chocolate banana.
I was just trying to sound like a radio guy. That's what I get. Bye, everyone.